From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Lower Hay,
Outer Richmond,
Fremont,
South of Market,
the Marina,
the E,
Tro Hill, the Dirty 94107.
I'm from Israel, living in Santa Clara.
Coming up, we'll hear how a famous author's Calistoga honeymoon helped inspire his greatest work.
They kind of come up with this idea, oh, wouldn't it be fun to spend time in abandoned mining town someplace.
Then we visit a library exhibit that breaks with decorum.
It's scurrilous and scandalous and horrible. It's one of the worst examples of literature that we've ever seen.
And we'll hear about a book that's not a who done it, but a why they done it.
You'll be completely absorbed in this, like, incredibly atmospheric book. Plus there's murder and kissing.
It's a literary adventure today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Today's show will be one for the books, because it's all about books. Our friends at the Litography Project have been documenting literary history and culture in the Bay Area and sharing stories with us here on Cross Currents.
Ah, the Litography Project!
Shh. Your guide to the literary Bay Area.
Let's start by heading up to Calistoga. Most people who visit the town at the top of the Napa Valley come for the wine and the spa treatments. Few come for the literary history. But they could. One of the most romantic honeymoon getaways ever written about happened right near there 135 years ago. Instead of mud baths and geysers, picture an abandoned mining shack infested with snakes, poison oak, and rusty nails. Now picture a sickly writer and his new wife spending their first 2 months of married life living there. Sounds crazy, right? But that's exactly what Robert Louis Stevenson, author of the famous children's book Treasure Island, did. So how did his honeymoon change the course of literary history? KALW's Sarah Stodder brings us this story.
It all started with a dark-haired American beauty named Fanny Osborne.
Robert Louis Stevenson came to California for love.
That's Marissa Schleicher, executive director at the Robert Louis Stevenson Museum in St. Helena. She tells me that before he met Fanny, Robert Louis Stevenson, or Louis, as his friends called him, was just a rebellious young boy trying, and failing, to make it as a writer while living on his parents' dole. In the spring of 1876, he goes vacationing in a small French town with friends.
There is a married American woman there with her two children, and it turns out that this is the woman Stevenson will fall in love with.
Fanny lives in San Francisco, and when she goes back, Stevenson drops everything to follow her to America. On the journey, he gets sick. Scholars think he had either tuberculosis or a genetic disorder, and develops a skin condition he calls the itch. By the time he arrives at Fanny's door, he's in pretty bad shape.
He looked like he was about to fall dead. He lost so much weight. He was about 80 pounds. His clothes were falling off his body, and his entire skin had been rubbed raw because of the itch. It looked like he had been flayed, almost. And Fanny thinks, my God, what have I done?
The San Francisco fog only makes Stevenson's lungs worse. He even starts composing poems about his imminent death, like this one, which he called Requiem.
Under the wide and starry sky, dig the grave and let me lie. Glad did I live and gladly die, and I laid me down with a will.
Finally, Fanny gets a divorce, moves Stevenson into her house, and nurses him back from the brink of death. They get married in the summer of 1880, as soon as he can make it to the church.
Stevenson and Fanny are adventurous sorts. They always have been. And so they kind of come up with this idea, oh, wouldn't it be fun to spend time in an abandoned mining town someplace?
And so, even though Stevenson is still weak, and they have Fanny's 10-year-old son, Lloyd, in tow, the newlyweds make their way by ferry and stagecoach to Calistoga for their honeymoon. A place, they're told by friends, with less fog and lots of restorative sunshine. When they get there, they hear about this place called the Old Silverado Mine. As the name suggests, it had once been a promising silver mine, but boom and bust had left it decrepit and abandoned. Stevenson has a good feeling about it, though, as he writes in his journal.
As from every point in Calistoga, Mount St. Helena could be seen towering in the air, There, just where the eastern foothills join the mountain, was Silverado. The name had already pleased me. The high station pleased me still more.
And they realized, huh, this'll be perfect. We can stay in an abandoned mining town, basically squat there since no one really owns it, and they won't have to pay anything to stay there.
But Silverado definitely has quirks. The wooden shack is built right up against the mountain so that all three rooms have to be entered through separate doors on top of each other. Imagine climbing through your third floor window in order to enter your bedroom. A layer of dirt covers the rusty mining equipment strewn all over the house. Worse, there's poison oak sprouting up through the floorboards. In Stevenson's published account, he's the one who roots it out. But in his unpublished letters, he admits Fanny deals with it.
Fanny had forgotten to put oil upon her face and was promptly poisoned with poison oak, the curse of this country. No offense to rattlesnakes or hairy tarantulas.
Despite her own terrible case of the itch, Fanny makes the best of their new home.
I put in doors and windows of light frames covered with white cotton, with bits of leather from the old boots for hinges, made seats and beds, and got things to look quite homelike.
Once Fanny gets the house in order, Stevenson begins to recover from his illness. Fanny describes their newlywed routine in a letter to her mother-in-law with more detail than most people might offer.
Every morning, he lay naked in the sun, browning one side and the other, finishing with a rubdown of oil.
Stevenson also spends his time playing with Fanny's son, Lloyd. The 10-year-old boy is delighted when Stevenson makes up adventure stories, especially stories about pirates.
He had read Defoe and different tales of the pirate golden age. And so when he's playing with Lloyd, of course, with the history of pirates off of the coast of California, they start these imaginary games here.
After months of pirate games on Mount St. Helena, Stevenson starts hatching an idea for a book that changes his family's fortunes forever.
Treasure Island, the story which thrilled 200 million readers throughout the world.
We can take this ship right now.
Then I say cut their throats. And I say there'll be no killing till I give the word. Shipmates.
Shipmates.
It's a story of buccaneers and buried gold, told from the point of view of a young boy who comes of age through a swashbuckling adventure. All his life, Stevenson has written unsuccessful travelogues and essays, but this new book is different. Marissa says his stay at the Silverado Mine is a big part of the reason why.
He sees this beautiful landscape. He wants to create these tales to entertain his new family. It really helps evolve his writing to being an author who takes the world around him and synthesizes it into an enjoyable romp for everyone.
When it's published in 1883, Treasure Island is an instant hit, and Stevenson becomes an international celebrity. At the height of his stardom, he publishes the journal from his honeymoon on Mount St. Helena, which he calls the Silverado Squatters, and it flies off the shelves.
Really, Lewis was the first one to bring this neck of the woods out to the world. During the entire time he's here, he's writing about what he sees, the people he meets, and keeping a very specific journal that he plans to turn into a book, so that by the time it gets published, it's kind of the first international PR for the region.
Schramsberg is one of the two wineries visited by Stevenson in Silverado Squatters, and from reading his book, it looks like he had a good time.
So local, so quintessential is a wine, that it seems the very birds in the veranda might communicate a flavor, and that romantic cellar influenced the bottle next to be uncorked in Pimlico, and the smile of jolly Mr. Schramm might mantle in the glass.
Though no one knew who Stevenson was at the time, the winemakers were quick to capitalize on the anecdote once he became famous. Here's Matthew Levy, marketing manager at Schramsberg.
It paid off for Schramsberg for sure, and this really was a international platform for them to utilize.
And it wasn't just Schramsberg. All of Napa Valley received a publicity boost from Silverado Squatters. The welcome sign still features a quote from Stevenson, who once described Napa's wine as bottled poetry.
Californians loved him. They loved that he loved California and he loved being here. And so the people of Napa County and the people in San Francisco and Monterey, they just were big, big fans.
They were such big fans that in 1911, long after Stevenson and Fanny were gone, a women's organization in Napa County erected the stone tablet that marks the spot where their honeymoon shack once stood.
Turn left onto California 29 North Robert Louis Stevenson's historic trail to Silverado.
In a quiet canyon on the side of Mount St. Helena, I hike past the stone tablet and further up the hill in search of the old Silverado mine. It's a tough climb. I have no idea how the very weak Stevenson did it. But I finally reach the mouth of the mine shaft on a hill overlooking the spot where the honeymoon shack used to be. It's cool and dark, covered in powdery red stones, no silver to be seen. There's something peaceful about it, though. An old wooden miner's cabin. Convertible double bunk beds in a room with a view. Fog-free weather. Endless pirate games. Come to think of it, that does sound like the perfect honeymoon. For Cross Currents in Calistoga, I'm Sarah Stotter.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Early this year, two gunmen opened fire in the office of the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, killing 12 employees. The attack was in response to cartoon depictions of the Prophet Muhammad that some perceived as offensive. Earlier this month, the Pen American Center recognized Charlie Hebdo with their Freedom of Expression Courage Award. That action, in turn, caused almost 200 writers to sign a letter of protest, complaining that the satirical magazine was promoting, quote, cultural intolerance and belittling the disenfranchised generally. Charlie Hebdo is one of many magazines featured in a timely exhibit at San Francisco's main library. It's called Mad World, Subversive Humor Magazines from the Shmulowitz Collection of Wit and Humor. KLW's Stephen Shore tells us about it.
The first thing a visitor sees when entering this year's exhibit from the Shmulowitz Collection of Wit and Humor at San Francisco's main library is a large poster of a Charlie Hebdo magazine cover.
It presents a cartoon of Muhammad with a sign in front of him saying, Je suis Charlie, tu es pardonné, all is forgiven.
Andrea Grimes is the librarian in charge of the Shmulowitz Collection.
And I'm Special Collections Librarian in the Book Arts and Special Collections Center.
There's been a public exhibit from this collection of wit and humor every year since the mid-1950s. When Grimes first started working on this year's show, she was planning a display of general humor magazines.
And then the Charlie Hebdo killings happened, and my focus shifted dramatically. So I thought that it would be more controversial, actually, something that would cause more of a conversation with viewers if I presented satirical magazines, and that's how that came about.
The first issue of the magazine published the week after the attack is on a plexiglass-covered table, one of 14 housing the exhibit. Each table has a poster hung above it, highlighting the contents. One is devoted to an American humor publication that inspired Charlie Hebdo, Mad Magazine. Grimes remembers sneak reading piles of Mad as a girl.
Even I knew something was radical about it because we were all being told that we weren't allowed to read it.
The example on display deals with Nikita Khrushchev's visit to the U.S. when he was head of the Soviet Union. The joke is a discussion about which famous actor of the time might serve as Khrushchev's interpreter.
So it's very, you know, it's political, it's subversive, it's funny, it's totally of the time.
And very well drawn.
Yes.
Another display across the room introduces visitors to a Soviet publication.
Crocodile, the official humor magazine of the Soviet Union, was founded in 1922 and ran through, I believe, 1989.
During the height of the Cold War in the 50s and 60s, there was such a controversy about Crocodile that it was banned in the United States.
They refused to send it through the U.S. mail to fulfill the subscription to the San Francisco Public Library. And there's all this correspondence, you know, the why we can't do it. It's scurrilous and scandalous and horrible. It's one of the worst examples of literature that we've ever seen. And it has no redeeming value. Blah. And Nat begged to differ.
Nat would be Nat Shmulowitz. Try saying that 10 times fast. Nat Shmulewitz was a lawyer.
Nat Shmulewitz also went on to become a library trustee for a very long time, and in 1947, as a measure of his interest in the San Francisco Public Library, he gave his collection of jest books.
Jest books. Today we would call them joke books. They make up the foundation of this collection. When Nat traveled, which was often, he'd pop into bookshops looking for a local laugh. The result?
Now the collection has about 37 languages and dialects in it. By visiting the Shmulewitz collection of wit and humor, everyone has a chance to see more than 450 years of a very lively collection.
One local satirical publication featured in this exhibit was so underground when it came out that today its originator has effectively disowned it. I'm talking about The Nose, founded by Jack Boulware. He's now the director of Litquake, the San Francisco-based organization that, quote, fosters interest in literature.
I don't really ever tell people about it. I never include it in my bio.
Because this was a joke on journalism? Why?
Well, nobody's going to pay you to do this sort of stuff.
It's tough approaching advertisers when your magazine has stories with titles like How to Eat Your Own Dog. That really happened. The Nose, like Charlie Hebdo, also made fun of religion. One cover, currently on display from 1994, is titled From Chastity Belts to Biker Gangs, Those Crazy Christians.
The illustration is a photograph of a guy who looks a lot like Jesus sitting on a Harley.
Boulware says there was no protest about this. Why?
We didn't have a very large circulation, 40,000 total.
Boulware credits the library's Shmulewitz collection as a big inspiration for The Nose.
Before we launched the magazine, I would come up here in the library and read examples of published humor from around the world. It was such a treasure trove because where would you find that sort of stuff? Where would you find this kind of inspiration?
When asked about whether satire can go too far, as in the case of Charlie Hebdo, Boulware prefers to judge not on that topic.
In the case of Charlie Hebdo, it's difficult for Americans to really comment on this because we don't live in France. We don't know their culture. We don't know the history of this publication.
He does find humor in the open letter signed by a couple hundred authors protesting Charlie Hebdo receiving this year's Courage Award from the Penn American Center.
I do enjoy the fact that a lot of them had admitted they'd never read it. and that to me says a lot. You should, if you're going to formally step out and denounce something, you should at least read it.
And that, says Andrea Grimes, is one reason the library has this collection.
Satirical magazines are a reminder of the importance of freedom of speech, the ability to read, the freedom to think without being persecuted in one way or another.
Nat Shmulewitz had a motto, one the library keeps alive.
Without humor, we are doomed.
And he might have added, then as now, sometimes we have to laugh to keep from crying. At San Francisco's main library, I'm Stephen Short for CrossCurrents.
The exhibit Mad World, Subversive Humor Magazines from the Shmulewitz Collection of Wit and Humor is on display at the San Francisco Main Library through this weekend. More details at klw.org. Click CrossCurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. We've been talking about literature and magazines. Now let's go a little deeper into the minds of Bay Area writers with two book reports, a series we present in conjunction with the Litography Project. First, we'll hear from Maggie Tokuda Hall, a writer living in San Francisco, about a book that's meaningful to her.
My book report is on The Secret History by Donna Tartt. It would be a murder mystery, except for that you know who did it from the first page and who's died. It's really about figuring out why, and it's about a group of classic students in a college in upstate Vermont. The first time I read it, the thing that struck me was that the characters were so three-dimensional that they actually felt like people I knew. And when the book was over, I had that feeling of like summer camp being over, like all these people I'd become friends with, these murderers, were not a part of my life anymore. I think I caught it at exactly the right moment in my life. I was in college, and I read it my first semester sophomore year, and then after that I reread it every semester and every semester of grad school as well, just once through, and I always found something new. Like, I think her craft is immaculate, and so every time I would sit down to read this book, something I had never thought of before would become apparent. So this is super early in the novel, and these six classic students are sitting down with this professor who has a very profound effect on them, and it basically sets up a philosophy that the way that they hear it allows them to make the choices that lead to the murder. And they're talking about Aristotle, I guess, is the other thing. And I believe Aristotle is correct. After all, what are the scenes in poetry graven in our memories, the ones that we love the most? Precisely these. The murder of Agamemnon and the wrath of Achilles. Dido on the funeral pyre. The daggers of the traitors in Caesar's blood. Remember how Suetonius describes his body being borne away on the litter with one arm hanging down? Death is the mother of beauty, said Henry. And what is beauty? Terror. Well said, said Julian. Beauty is rarely soft or consolatory. Quite contrary, genuine beauty is always quite alarming. Somebody who's not necessarily listening to this as a as like the end-all be-all of truth, just hears something that's, I think, kind of a profound commentary on life. I think that the reason that so many people enjoy this book is that it's incredibly intelligent while still being really entertaining. This is the perfect book to pull you out of a reading slump. Like, if you've been having a hard time, you're floating from book to book and nothing is really sucking you in, this is the easy one that you can pick up and, you know, for a week or 2 weeks or however long it takes to read you, you'll be completely absorbed in this, like, incredibly atmospheric book. Plus, there's murder and kissing, so it's got all the good stuff.
That was author and illustrator Maggie Takuda Hall speaking with Nina Gunsler Debs for the Book Report. We started this show with a story about love. We heard about a wild honeymoon in Calistoga. Now we'll travel to French colonial Vietnam with a book report from author Cara Black.
My book report is on The Lover by Marguerite Duras. It's set in pre-war Indochina, so the late 1920s, 1930s, when France had Indochina as a colony. It's a love story between a 15-and-a-half-year-old French girl who was born in Indochina, grew up there, and a man she meets who becomes her Chinese lover. The background is that she's been living in Saigon because she's been going to high school there and staying in a boarding like dormitory. And her mother and her two brothers live in the countryside in Sa Dec. And her mother is a headmistress of a school, but they're very, very poor. Her father died when she was 4 years old, so the mother has been left with her and her two brothers. And she's been raised like a native, actually. You know, she speaks perfect Vietnamese. And what's really striking is that the story actually starts when she's on the ferry going back to school in Saigon, and she's wearing one of her mother's old silk dresses, gold lamé dancing shoes, and a fedora that her mother bought her in a market. So she's really kind of a young, independent, kind of wild thing who is a bit of a rebel. And there's a young Chinese man who's on the ferry, who has a limousine, and they start talking. And that's where the story starts. Quand on se quitte, on oublie tout, mais revenir est si doux. This is really meaningful to me because I read it, maybe 20 years ago, and it really struck a chord. And I read it usually every year. I reread it. I think it's sort of an underrated masterpiece. it hit me because there's so much honesty in this story. I mean, she was very courageous to write this. She bears her emotions. And for a woman to write about that, it's also about a young woman's awakening. It's not a coming of age, but it's her awakening to being a woman, to life, to society, to what's really going on. And her writing is just so incredibly gorgeous. And there's sparse writing. It's kind of economical, yet these beautiful lyrical, you know, passages. You are on that ferry going over the Mekong, you know, and, you know, you see the brown river and you hear the people chewing pumpkin seeds or whatever. And there's an immediacy and you're brought into the scene and you're brought into her emotions. You should read this book by the water someplace in a hammock or in an old rattan chair, you know, the kind they have, you know, in French cafes. And whether it's a river or the sea, you know, just let that feeling, you know, of water take you over.
That was author Cara Black speaking with Nina Gensler-Debs for the Book Report. What books have changed your life? Share your thoughts and learn about others on Facebook. We're at KALW. And keep those emails coming at news@kalw.org. We love hearing from you. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Olivia Cueva, Audrey Dilling, Rachel Dornhelm, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ted Muldoon, Judy Silber, Stephen Short, Todd Whitney, and Liza Veal. Seth Samuel engineered today's show. Our line producer was Nina Gensler-Debs. The managing producer is Julie Kane. Managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.